I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. The book has been described as lucid, staggeringly researched, and important. It is Champlain's dream, the visionary adventurer who made a new world in Canada. The author is a 2005 Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of Washington's Crossing, David Hackett Fisher. That Samuel de Champlain is a remarkable figure in our history is without question, and that he's been overlooked recently, even outright ignored, is also true, which was reason enough for the author to write this book now, and in time for the 400th anniversary of many of Champlain's achievements. David Hackett Fisher is university professor and Warren Professor of History at Brandeis University. He's written numerous books, including Paul Revere's Ride and Albion's Seed, among others. Champlain's Dream is published by Knopf and retails for $37. In Toronto this day, please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, David Hackett Fisher. Good morning, Professor Fisher.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
You wrote about Paul Revere and Washington. Why a book on Champlain?
All of my books, those and one before them, Albion Seed, are about origins. I've been deeply interested in the difference that small beginnings can make in the growth of large nations. And I started in my own country of the United States looking at the origins of our regional cultures from small migrations from Britain in the 17th century, and then to national origins. And now historians all over the world are thinking globally about their origins, and they're not limited by national boundaries as we were some time ago. So I got started on Champlain.
I first heard about the book. Well, they've been talking about this book in this country for a very long time. When they do those fall book previews, you know, yours was an often mentioned book. I had John Ralston Saul in here several weeks ago, and he mentioned it as well. The response to this book has been pretty good, hasn't it?
It has so far, yes.
Is it the same in your country?
It is. We've been getting good reviews everywhere, and quite a lot of people are discovering Champlain in my country. I think. For the first time.
It's been nearly 400 years since the man lived. One wonders what more have we learned about him, or what new have we learned about him?
A lot has been learned in the past, I'd say, 8 years. Before that time, Champlain was widely known in Canada as a national figure, the founder of Quebec, the father of Canada, he was often called. And then those claims invited the attentions of the iconoclasts and debunkers, and they went to work on Champlain, tried to cut him down to size, and there were some very brutal pieces published about him. Then a long silence, and that was in the 70s, 80s, 90s. It was a time of political correctness, and dead white male explorers were not welcome in academe, so he began to fade away. But then after 2000, historians have suddenly gotten interested in him, and it's happening in Canada, it's happening all around the world. France, some of the most interesting work has been done in Italy and Spain on him, and we're all finding him a figure of not only of local interest in my part of the United States, as he is in down East Maine. We have a very proprietary feeling about him, and not only as a national figure in Canada, but as a world figure. All those things at once.
And why do you think it is that I mean, in the book, you sort of describe him as a century plant that blooms every century. Our interest in him. Why do you think it is? Is it because we're so close to the 400th anniversary of?
I think that's a good part of it. But it's something more than that for the historians who are getting interested. And they are, as they're thinking more in terms of transnational history, Champlain becomes more and more important.
So in some of these books by the debunkers of Champlain, how is he portrayed?
He was, there was one by a man named Brucchese, who, and the title in French, or it might be translated, was Champlain a liar? And the answer was yes, in his judgment, allegedly making up, inventing out of whole cloth one of his reports of his travels in the West Indies. That and several other pieces like that and other attacks inspired some of the scholarship, and it's confirmed the accuracy of Champlain's work. It's falsified the debunkers and the iconoclasts. And so we're really in a new stage of historical studies on this man.
And when you came to him, did you admire him off the bat, or did you have to come to that afterwards?
Well, I knew about him first of all as a explorer, a brilliant seaman, and a very good map maker. And then as we worked with him, we kept finding new layers in his life. One of the first layers was his relations with the Indians, and he really got on with them in a way that was different from most other European explorers in the early 17th century. And then we began to discover other things. It wasn't merely that he founded Quebec, but that he started three populations growing, all French-speaking in North America. One was the Quebecois population. The other was the Acadian of founding, and then the third were the Métis, the mixed ones, as he called them, who began to grow from unions between Champlain's interpreters and the and Indians in the St. Lawrence Valley.
He wasn't a saint, though. I reading the book, four of his men tried to kill him at one point.
Yes, that's right. In Quebec, 2008, every colony that French leaders founded before Quebec failed, and many of the failures were from rebellions. Champlain faced that in the first summer, and it was a very broadly based conspiracy. He was driving his men very hard, racing the winter, to try to get the first buildings raised. And they turned against him. He found out about it, was able to arrest the ringleaders, offered the other settlers, who were mostly had joined into the conspiracy, a choice. He offered them he gave them a choice of full obedience or instant death. And then he tried the leader and ordered him to be instantly beheaded, which was done. And the head was mounted on a pike in Quebec. He was very ruthless that way.
Before he came to this side of the world, in France, was he an important figure in French society?
He was caught up in important events, I would say. He rose from, I think, fairly humble beginnings, and then became a soldier in the French Wars of Religion, and it was a terrible time for that nation. There were something like 9 wars that went on for nearly 40 years, and they were incredibly violent. Not much difference between a distinction between civilians and soldiers. And the casualties are estimated recently at 2 to 3 million people. Also, these were religious wars, and the atrocities were beyond description. Champlain lived through that. He became a soldier, soldiering for Henry IV, the first Bourbon king of France. And what Henry IV sought to do and succeeded in doing was to bring peace to France, to conquer a peace by defeating these other groups. And also to build a system of toleration, which he did in the Edict of Nantes in the same year that the religious wars ended. Champlain was part of that effort. And then after the wars, he was given a new job, which was to look abroad, visit New Spain, and report back to the king on how that empire was run. And that's what he did, and that led to the next stage of his life.
Was he related to Henry IV?
He may have been. Many historians, both Marcel Trudel in Canada and also Hubert Deschamps in France, believe that Champlain's life makes no sense unless we assume that he was probably the illegitimate offspring of some very eminent family. And I think it's at least conceivable that he could have been the bastard son of Henry IV.
The times in which he lived and the people who he lived amongst is awfully interesting. This group of French humanists, you write in the book, inherited the Renaissance and inspired the Enlightenment. What did they believe, and what was Champlain's?
And I think it developed in reaction to the horrors of these religious wars, and became deeply interested in creating a world of that was organized on values of peace and toleration, and it was humanistic in that sense. These were many circles of French humanists who all supported Henry IV, one of the ones that we know best and who wrote them in some way the most eloquent essays was Montaigne, who was very much of this way of thinking. Champlain was traveling in those circles.
And how many crossings did he make of the Atlantic?
27. He was going back and forth because he was trying to keep the grand design for America going in the face of many enemies and difficulties on both sides of the Atlantic. So he shuttled back and forth, often in the most dangerous times to make a crossing. He would leave in late winter, in very early March, from France, and he was crossing the Atlantic in a time of storms on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean, and then also of drifting ice. Even the ice pack got as far south as Halifax, even a little lower in this period that climate historians call the Little Ice Age. He ran into that, was often caught in the ice.
He documented the environment and climate of the times, didn't he? Quite significantly. How valuable is that?
Well, I think it's exceptionally valuable because he was a very close observer. He was a keen naturalist. He was deeply interested in the countryside itself, and he wrote very graphic accounts of what he had seen. We can see this world before the European settlements through his eyes, and it's a fascinating sight. And we can also, as we travel around, in Canada, in down East Maine, in France, we can see much of his world in places where it has changed remarkably little. This is the case in, let's say, the Saguenay River in Canada, or in some of the islands of off the coast of Maine. And it's very much that way in the little towns of France where he was most active. The large cities grew near them and left them behind, and they were frozen in time, and we can still visit Champlain's world.
This idea of ferreting, this was his method of exploring the coast. What did that involve?
It meant getting very close in studying the coast in detail. He made maps that were more accurate than his instruments, and the way he did that, I think, was by this method of ferreting, in which he was using his lead lines and compasses. That's mostly, those were mainly his important tools, and the result were maps of astounding precision, much better than any other map makers in North America in that period.
He wrote prodigiously, and as the author of this, you must have read a great deal that he wrote. How accurate was he? Like, I mean, did he sort of portray himself favorably?
Yeah, the answer is by and large yes. And as to portraying himself, as to accuracy, it was very difficult to answer that question until recently, when we're getting a lot of archaeological evidence that tests various parts of his accounts, and also we're getting more and more accounts from other people who were there, and we were getting also stories from the Indians, and most of these accounts, in fact, nearly all of them, confirm the accuracy of Champlain's descriptions. He comes out very well by the evidence of other sources.
What about his relationship with women?
Always troubled from the start, and people have wondered about that. One of his most troubled relations was with his wife. It was a child marriage. He was nearly 40. She was 12. She was forced to marry him against her will, and Champlain was doing that. It was the year 1610 when Henry IV had been assassinated by a religious fanatic. And the wife of Henry IV had taken over and was the queen regent of France. She had very little interest in Champlain's purposes. And so what Champlain did was to build a new place at court by a marriage with the daughter of one of the most powerful administrative figures at the court. Her name was Helen Boulay, and she was a young, she was really a girl when they married, but up to live together until she was 14. And then when that time came, she ran away. And there was a scandal as a consequence. She later came back and lived in the same house with him. We know very little about the marriage itself. We think, I think there's pretty good evidence that their relations grew better in the middle years of their marriage. She went to France with Champlain in 1620, stayed there for nearly 5 years, and got interested in the Indians just as Champlain was, and they shared a common purpose there. Then the marriage grew more distant in its last years, but it was a very troubled relationship throughout. Champlain also had difficult relations with other women, and some historians, at least one recent iconoclast, has suggested that he may have been homosexual. I think that's probably not true. He wrote about Indian women, admiring their beauty, and with a tone that suggested that he was a decidedly heterosexual male. There's another iconoclast who's asserted that Champlain got syphilis in the West Indies, and that was a factor. There is absolutely no evidence for that whatsoever. I think he was a man who lived amongst men, found women distant and incomprehensible, as I think men often do, and it was a sort of a darker thread that ran through his life.
As for his personal life, he didn't write about himself that much, did he?
He wrote very little about himself. He wrote a great deal about what he did, but very little about who he was. And it wasn't merely that he avoided the subject, but he was, I think, even hiding himself in his origins, in his age, in the most elemental facts of his life. It could have been because he was of illegitimate birth. But whatever the reason, he, even as he avoided the subject, he wrote what now fills 6 volumes of material, and he betrayed a good deal of himself. And I think we can find him in his own writings. Also, French scholars have found a lot of materials in local archives, in provincial archives. And they give us bits and pieces, which add up to more and more knowledge about him.
If it wasn't for him, New France would have failed.
It did fail repeatedly in his time, and he revived it several times. So I think we can see him. He's also the only person who was continuously a leader in New France throughout the period from 1604 to 1635, 3 decades, and was absolutely at the center of what happened then.
And thus essential to the founding of this country, correct?
I think so, and I think there may be lasting consequences from what he did here. I think that idea of humanity, that way of getting on with people unlike himself, the relations between the French and Indians that he helped to start, led to a different sort of relationship in Canada from what has prevailed in the United States. I think when we compare our two histories in terms of relations between Europeans and Indians, the results of that comparison are not to the advantage of the United States. Something went differently and better in Canada that way. Not that it was perfect, but there was a kind of lasting consequence of those humanistic beginnings and of the relations that began to grow between the French settlers and the Indians.
What contemporary lessons can we glean from Champlain that would be useful for not only our leaders of today, but ourselves?
Well, one important lesson comes from a little book he wrote at the end of his career. He wrote it not about what he did, but how it was done. And it was a treatise on leadership, centering on one word, one French word, which has no English equivalent. The word is prévoyance, which is often translated foresight. But in fact, it means the opposite of foresight in some ways. Foresight to us often means having some knowledge of the future. But prévoyance was about how to plan and act for the long run in a world where knowledge of the future is denied to us, where one is living in the face of deep and deeply threatening uncertainties, as was the case whenever he crossed the Atlantic, and when he was struggling at home with the enemies of New France, and when he was working in America. And he wrote a book on how to do that, and the rules are very interesting, and I think maybe unique in the history of leadership. And we could learn from that, in that we could use with some prévoyance when we are living in the midst of deeply threatening uncertainties in our own time.
How long does a book like this take for you to write, to research, and so on?
4 years full time. But the other answer to that is all my life. I've been hunting and gathering for as long as I can remember.
And is it an enjoyable experience for you?
I love it. It's the moral equivalent of hunting. If we find our quarry, we bring him to life. It's the opposite of hunting in that way. But there's the excitement of the hunting and the gathering, which I find deeply rewarding.
And are you working on another book now?
I am. It's about New Zealand. We've been teaching in New Zealand, and we found another story of origins there, and another variation on some of these themes. I think people in New Zealand have developed a particular interest in fairness, and they did that, I think, from the very beginning of their history. They came from England at a time when freedom and liberty was not problematic to them, as it was for the founders of the colonies that grew into the United States, but rather they thought that their country in England had been deeply unfair, and they brought that obsession to New Zealand and have developed a culture that, in pursuit of fairness, from which we all have much to learn.
That sounds fascinating. Well, we'll await that, and until then, we'll read this book. Professor Fisher, it's been a pleasure having you on today. Much continued good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. I greatly enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you. The book is called Champlain's Dream, The Visionary Adventure Who Made a New World in Canada, $37 from Random House. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.